listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. The Apes of Wrath. NFTs, like Bored Apes, were supposed to be a fast track to billions. Their rapid decline says a lot about crypto, celebrity, and art in the hype era, by Nate Freeman. Opening illustration shows a panel of various cartoonish apes. In September of last year, Sotheby's offered up for auction a cache of 101 Bored Ape NFTs as a lot in a special sale called Ape In. The digital art revolution had seemingly remade the art market in the months prior, and this was the finest collection of non-fungible tokens ever assembled by one of the world's oldest auction houses, founded in 1744. Scrolling through the catalog of cartoon monkeys and funny hats and jackets, one could see a rare bored ape with a solid gold fur and holographic eyes, and rarer yet, an ape with an unshaven face eating a piece of pizza. For digital art enthusiast who aspired to membership in the Bored Ape Yacht Club, this was a huge deal. The house was confident that Ape In could ride the NFT momentum that had been building since the previous spring, when Every Days, a work by the digital artist Beeple, sold at Christie's for $69 million. And the house could peddle these online pictures of weird primates for a similar sum. A promotional video showed the cartoon monkeys in DJ booths spinning EDM at a party in what appeared to be Sotheby's global headquarters on York Avenue in Manhattan. Young and ambitious specialist in the house's digital art department, a brand new endeavor, bullishly offered the lot at an estimate of somewhere between $12 million and $18 million. Instead, the lot sold for $24.4 million, smashing records for Bored Apes. What newly minted patron of the digital arts snagged this for eight figures? At the time, Sotheby's wouldn't comment on the buyer, apart from saying that among those heavily involved in the bidding were legacy art collectors. We're seeing a growing number of traditional art buyers getting interested in NFTs, Michael Buhana, co-head of digital art sales at the house, told Art News at the time. And why not? Some thought these monkeys with headgear and lasers for eyeballs could be worth billions in our not-so-distant virtual lives. Bored Ape Yacht Club, the moniker given to the 10,000 unique iterations of the NFT created by Yuga Labs in April 2021 and initially sold for $190 a pop, tweeted out, "To the buyer, I think we speak for everybody when we say welcome to the club." It punctuated the message with a skull and crossbones emoji, a monkey emoji, and a boat emoji to signify a yacht. Increasingly, it looks as though the buyer was not a traditional art collector, or even a human that other ape owners could welcome to a club. The blockchain is an opaque at best space, but in the months following the purchase, some close observers settled on the idea that the buyer of the apes at Sotheby's was FTX, the crypto exchange that recently crashed and burned, resulting in an inquiry into the possible market machinations of its founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, who is currently charged with crimes related to the overnight disappearance of billions of his investors' funds in the fall. Bankman-Fried has pleaded not guilty and in a statement said he did not steal funds. The evidence, per the blockchain Twitter hive mind, boiled down to this: A few months after the Sotheby's sale, FTX had listed the 101 apes on a page detailing its NFT holdings. While a number of interested watchers pieced all this together, Connor Grogan, a director at rival exchange Coinbase, presented a particularly digestible version of the extremely Web3-style paper trail. When FTX began supporting Ethereum NFTs on its sales platform in December 2021, some of the apes FTX had available to sell were clearly identifiable from the Sotheby's sale 3 months earlier. One Twitter watcher posted a screenshot of the platform that shows 8 of the Sotheby's sold apes. Sotheby's declined to comment to Vanity Fair on the Bored Ape sale. That December 1st, FTX announced the marketplace with a video where the apes from the Sotheby's sale were front and center, to which two-time NBA MVP Stephen Curry, who had recently been named FTX's global ambassador, responded, "Cool announcement video, but my editing skills are missed," adding a crying laughing emoji. When a new crypto denomination, ApeCoin, debuted in March 2022, $8 million worth of the stuff was transferred from the digital wallet that made the purchase at Sotheby's back to Alameda Research. Alameda is the sister firm of FTX, where complaints allege Bankman-Fried could park his missing billions. More fun with org charts. Yuga Labs has been clear that it is not the entity that launched ApeCoin. That would be something called ApeCoin DAO. It just so happens, as the tech outlet The Verge reported in March 2022, that ApeCoin DAO gave a good chunk of the early windfall of the coin's launch to Yuga Labs, Yuga Labs founders, and the VCs who backed the project. And what firm was a prominent part of Yuga Labs' $450 million fundraising round in 2022? FTX. According to blockchain Twitter's sleuthing, here we had a major Yuga Labs investor inflating the value of Yuga Labs' most valuable asset by bidding it up at auction. With Bankman-Fried now facing charges of fraud, money laundering, and campaign finance violations, his company's trove of bored apes remains in the FTX wallet. The old link to the NFT collection now goes to a claims agency. SBF and the Mystery of the 101 Apes, working title, is emblematic of the art world's deal-with-the-devil approach to the NFT market. During the bull years, well, months, really, of the phenomenon, auction houses built up their digital art departments. Sotheby's Metaverse, Christie's 3.0, etc. And even the galleries established separate wings to pump out NFT sales, most notably Pace Galleries' Pace Verso. Hollywood talent agencies hired Silicon Valley-adjacent fixers to score content deals to make movie franchises from NFT IP. In 2021, according to the research from Statista, an estimated $2.6 billion in art NFTs were sold, and anyone in the art market who hopped on that gravy train seemed to be getting a cut. As even a casual observer of the art world, Silicon Valley, or global finance might note, hype is very much not just a byproduct, but a full-on function of the markets at this stage of the game. For all of the decentralized spin and non-fungible hot air, the most innovative trait of NFTs, and the shrewdest play by their evangelist, has been their harnessing of the world's great engines for wealth speculation. It has been a phenomenon that is part Art Basel, Miami Beach, part Davos, part Burning Man. In the months that the apes and their digital brethren grew ever more valuable, it was hard to shake the feeling that no matter how the market played out, we'd at least get some kind of 21st century parable from the whole affair. Sure enough, in mid-2022, the bottom fell out. In late June, crypto hedge fund Three Arrows Capital went belly up, leaving investors both big and small holding the bag. Genesis Capital had put billions into 3AC. All gone. Terra, a $60 billion Singapore-based crypto exchange, imploded spectacularly after its stablecoin, UST, collapsed, and its token, Luna, fell from a price of $80 to pennies. And then the FTX Zeppelin fire brought the crypto crisis to the front pages, causing a global sell-off of risky assets. The cheapest available Bored Ape in April 2022 was about $429,000. And earlier that year, Justin Bieber reportedly had to pay $1.29 million to get his. In the days after FTX imploded, apes were available for as little as $76,400. "Oh, the bubble burst," said Kimberly Grauer, the head of research at crypto data firm Chain Analysis and an expert on trends in cryptocurrency, economics, and crime. "People stopped viewing it as a way to make money via speculation. It dried up. It cooled down. People were less eager to put their money in NFTs than they were before." The crisis has forced economists, cultural prognosticators, art world rubberneckers, and tech world cheerleaders to collectively grapple with the phenomenon that we witnessed. Was it a legitimate burst of enthusiasm for a revolutionary way to create and sell a new kind of art? Or a tulipomania speculation bonanza that was driven purely by greed and hype? Here's another way of framing the question. Were the art world figures who presumably knew better selling snake oil to Marx? Or did they really believe in the value of these digital tokens? Benedict Evans, a tech thinker who is an analyst at Mosaic Ventures and had a stint at Andreessen Horowitz, though he had left A16Z before it led the $450 million fundraising round for Yuga Labs just before the crypto winter, told me, essentially caveat emptor, "Does a real estate broker feel any obligation to tell you that you're in a real estate bubble and you shouldn't buy this?" Evans said. "No, that's not their job. Their obligation is still to the seller." But buyer beware of what exactly? It is hard to overstate how loud and how layered was the hype around certain NFTs, the Bored Apes included, at the boom's peak. In December, an explosive lawsuit started making its way through the U.S. District Court in the Western Division of the Central District of California, taking aim at the founders of Bored Ape and their most famous fans. The 94-page complaint reads like an episode of Entourage set in the midst of the crypto-crazed early 20s, starring a Mad Libs grab bag of rappers, zeitgeist hitters, and A-listers. Diplo, The Weeknd, Gwyneth Paltrow, Snoop Dogg, Post Malone, Future, Kevin Hart, and inevitably the Chainsmokers. The suit, seeking class action status for buyers of Yuga NFTs or ApeCoin, weaves a narrative of alleged crypto fraud. Hollywood machismo, social media, spamming, celebrity worship, and a little bit of Bono. In sum, it alleges that the rise of the Planet of the Bored Apes was a scheme to make the monkeys look like assets that celebrities and art dealers were spending millions to obtain. Those transactions were staged, the suit claims. The famous and influential were getting their apes gratis and were being paid to promote the stuff, a fact they failed to disclose. These famous celebrities, they're getting in, and they're going to cause a spike in the price as they continue to interact in the ecosystem. They're part of the club, and more people are going to want to have these to be a part of the club with the celebrities, said attorney John Jasnok, a partner at the San Diego firm Scott & Scott, which filed the case on behalf of a pair of aggrieved NFT and ApeCoin owners named Adonis Real and Adam Titcher. And so, oh, they're unique and they're scarce. It drives that thought that it'll be a successful investment for you. Perhaps you noticed in early 2022 that nearly every celeb was on a crypto company payroll. Curry was making bank as the spokesperson for FTX, and various celebrities were putting up Instagram stories about their pricey NFTs. And there was that Larry David Super Bowl ad. According to the suit, the alleged scheme began when Yuga Labs partnered with music industry veteran Guy Osiri, who manages Madonna and U2. Osiri, who's named as a defendant in the suit, allegedly brought in high-profile friends and clients to buy and promote their NFTs. But what the lawsuit alleges is that Osiri and company used a consumer crypto app called MoonPay, think Venmo or PayPal, but for crypto, to allow the transactions to occur without having to disclose them to investors. In addition, the suit alleges that Osiri's venture capital firm, Sound Ventures, of which Ashton Kutcher, who is not named as a defendant in the suit, is a partner, and several of the other celeb ape endorsers named elsewhere in the lawsuit, were early investors in MoonPay, allowing them to financially benefit from the cross-pollination and promotional efforts for the Yuga financial products. Together, Osiri, the MoonPay defendants, and the promoter defendants each shared the strong motive to use their influence to artificially create demand for the Yuga securities, which in turn would increase use of MoonPay's crypto service to handle this new demand, the suit reads. Next photo shows the logo of Bored Ape Yacht Club in neon, guerrilla marketing. The NFT craze was part Art Basel Miami Beach, part Davos, part Burning Man. The hype, in other words, was a feature, not a bug. At the same time, Osiri could also use MoonPay to obscure how he paid off his celebrity cohorts for their direct or off-label promotions of the Yuga financial products. Ask for comment, a Yuga Labs spokesperson said, "In our view, these claims are opportunistic and parasitic. We strongly believe that they are without merit and look forward to proving as much." A MoonPay spokesperson said, "MoonPay says all celebrity clients were charged in full for the price of the NFTs and a service fee." As of deadline, Osiri had not responded to request for comment, and the court docket shows that he was granted an extension to respond to the suit. While the lawsuit is in its earliest stages, it may have already provided some much-needed context to one of the more baffling exchanges of our entire pandemic-era screen consumption, the "I bought an ape" back and forth between Jimmy Fallon and Paris Hilton on The Tonight Show in January 2022, in which the pair, ape owners both, discussed the finer points of NFT shopping. Fallon, with the somber tone of a man who had come to terms with the state of his soul, said he picked his Breton-striped ape because he, too, wears striped shirts. Hilton, as if she hadn't the faintest idea what she was saying, offered, "I saw you on the show with Beeple, and you said you got it on MoonPay." As the suit alleges, for all its unintended comedic gold, the exchange was helping to build up the idea of bored apes as investment pieces worth millions and attract more buyers. As the plaintiffs and their lawyers tell it, celebrities talking about their apes on social media or late-night TV became the public-facing part of a plan in which their hundreds of thousands of dollars of NFTs translated to the popularity of ApeCoin, which translated to a $450 million seed fundraise and a $4 billion valuation. Neither Fallon nor Hilton responded to request for comment. "Did you watch the DJ Khaled one?" Jasnok, the lawyer, asked me. He was referring to footage of DJ Khaled, aughts-era hip-hop's walking exclamation point, standing on a yacht, looking at multiple phone screens, various people telling him, "You bought an ape, you bought an ape," as Khaled wobbles around confused. "Yeah, it's pretty bad," Jasnok said. "He's just like, I don't know what this is." In the auction world, the sale of the digital future was a relatively subtle proposition. The houses needed to incept the cultural cognoscenti and implant the idea that NFTs are art. Was Beeble's Everydays, a series of thousands of images and illustrations, some of which are sexist or downright puerile, actual fine art worthy of a downtown gallery opening and a celebratory private dinner at Frenchette, which Beeple really had thrown for him last March? In retrospect, is it a bit crazy to say things such as, "I look at life as pre-Beeple and post-Beeple, like the world thinks about before Jesus Christ and after," as Noah Davis, who arranged the $69 million Beeple sale at Christie's as the house's head of digital sales, really did once say. Davis has since left Christie's and now works as a brand lead at Yuga Labs for CryptoPunks, another of its NFT offerings. Think apes, but spiky-looking 8-bit cartoon guys. The auction houses had their boilerplate explanations of why a certain NFT should be contextualized as art, making sure they remain as devoted as ever to the seller, not the buyer. Did Beeple really achieve something historic when Christie's slotted his NFT Coom Walking Man sculpture, Human One, into its evening sale between paintings by Issy Wood and Stanley Whitney? With that sort of thinking in the air, it wasn't long before the digital art hype became a self-fulfilling prophecy. At a certain point, it didn't even matter if it was art. Auction houses sell wine and constitutions and sneakers and watches and first editions. If it's selling, you sell it. It's like Hollywood making movies about how Hollywood sucks. You actually embrace it, Evans, the crypto Sherpa, said. Like, yeah, I'll take that money. Surveying the digital currency and art landscape a few months after the FTX scandal, it's hard not to wonder if any of this stuff ever had any value beyond speculation. Jasnok, the plaintiff's lawyer in the Yuga suit, attempted to thread this needle by comparing the Bored Ape NFTs and their crypto complement, ApeCoin. The former can, in the broadest sense, be argued to be artwork. The latter is purely a unit of currency with no artistic value whatsoever, making it, in his estimation, a viable thing to be regulated. The linking of the two entities so closely is where things get tricky and the lawyers get involved. I think the concept of an NFT can have intrinsic value, and that a token can represent value in some fashion, and I think there's value in people liking the look of the artwork, he said. But in terms of it being a financial product, and how they were marketed and how they were sold, it really is an unregistered security, and it needs to be subject to proper disclosure. And once you get into generating all that hype around the Bored Ape itself, they release the ApeCoin token, which doesn't even have the pretense of a piece of art or anything. And that's just a straight-up unregistered security that is used for speculation and for trading. Evans offered another conundrum. When a market offers something for sale at a large sum, there is, at a base level, an understanding among the public that it has some legitimate importance. Perhaps the artwork is not to one's liking, but it has a provenance, and the artist is in museum collections, or there's historic relevance to something that makes it at the very least a curio. When you are buying vintage vinyl, or rare sneakers, or Marilyn Monroe's shoes, or Salvador Dali print, or whatever it is, you're getting something that has no tangible physical value, but you're also getting it in the belief that other people attribute value to that too, Evans said. There's like a deep cultural base that thinks Jordan sneakers are worth something, early Sex Pistols vinyl is worth something. And the challenge with all of these NFTs was you didn't really know that there was that broad, deep cultural base. It was just, oh my gosh, somebody just bought one for 200 grand. For the time being, some in the art world are still acting as though the devotion to NFTs could result in some kind of windfall. In October of last year, Sotheby's Metaverse offered the first NFTs by the artist Sebastião Salgado. But they weren't exactly lighting the place on fire. They cost $250 each. Back in 2021, the natively digital sale netted Sotheby's $17.1 million, with $11.75 million paid for a single CryptoPunk. But in February 2022, Sotheby's set up a special sale where it expected a set of 104 CryptoPunks to go for as much as $30 million, only to see the thing collapse minutes after the scheduled gavel in, when the consignor backed out, reportedly due to a lack of interest from bidders. The house didn't explain at the time, and the seller crowed online that it had all been an elaborate gaming of the system. Though just how anyone got played remains unclear. By last December, the natively digital sale seemed to have lost its luster entirely. Sotheby's offered the first ever Keith Haring NFT as the star lot of the sale, but it sold for $25,000, well below the $80,000 high estimate. Things aren't much better at Christie's, where the NFT platform Christie's 3.0 has a smattering of work for sale, mostly in the low four figures. Despite the fact that the auction house launched an on-chain marketplace in the Web3 space in 2022, sales of the stuff were way, way down year to year. In 2021, the house sold $150 million in NFTs. In 2022, sales were just $5.9 million, a 96% downturn. And it's not like Christie's had a bad year that dragged down the digital sector. The house saw a record $8.4 billion in top-line sales, and NFTs were just about 0.07% of the total. Neither Sotheby's nor Christie's responded when asked for comment on whether they plan to continue with their NFT platforms. There's no definitive way to say whether the NFT market will ever come back. When asked what the data says, Grauer, the crypto expert, said it's certainly a bear market at the moment, but things could hypothetically recover. A lot of people are very eager and say that we are in the right heads-down-and-build phase and are looking for the right projects to invest in when liquidity opens up in the next year or so, she said. Other people have said the bubble's burst, and I certainly don't have a strong idea of which one's correct. One tech outfit seems to have found a solution. In 2022, Skylar Hallgren, David Sawyer, and Zach Miller launched Unsellable, a startup that purchases worthless NFTs for a penny as a way to provide a tax write-off. It's proven quite popular with collectors looking to exit the space as quickly as possible. Those who have accepted the fact that these once promising investments are, in fact, devoid of value. The Unsellable collection, the startup's vast haul of worthless digital detritus, is currently home to more than 16,000 objects. LA Confidential by Joe Pompeo, with photographs by Martin Scheller, styled by Samantha Gasmer. With a classic flair for Hollywood intrigue, The Ankler has become an industry must-read. But can Richard Rushfield and Janice Min scale a scrappy newsletter into a media empire? Opening photo, get me rewrite, Richard Rushfield and Janice Min photographed on December 12th in Los Angeles in an office setting. On Sunday, October 9th, a year ago, Richard Rushfield's phone lit up with the type of jaw-dropper that can really get Twitter going on a weekend. Nikki Fink, legendary Hollywood journalist, dead at 68. Fink had largely been off the radar since parting ways with her self-made entertainment news website, Deadline, at the end of 2013. But her death from an unspecified prolonged illness was no less monumental. Gone was the mythically fearsome woman who, some two decades earlier, saw an opening in the staid landscape of Hollywood's trade press and drove an 18-wheeler straight through it, lobbing bombs at anyone in her path. Rushfield had a history of crossing Fink, as the furious messages in his email archives can attest. Nikki Fink, one step closer to dream of becoming world's worst boss, declared the headline of a Gawker post Rushfield wrote in 2009. As word of Fink's demise spread across the internet, Rushfield's blood started rising. Fink was a fearless trailblazer, the eulogies went, who disrupted entertainment journalism and redefined its relationship with the world it covers. Not untrue, but Rushfield saw it as revisionist history, glossing over Fink's dark side, the toxicity, the bullying, the lies, the sheer meanness. He started belting out an article for his own Hollywood publication, a subscription newsletter called The Ankler. "This is the story," he wrote, "of a very troubled writer who used the megaphone of journalism to work out her insecurities and issues in a hellstorm of performative rage, all while hiding, ailing, agoraphobic, sick, behind an online persona. If Donald Trump had been an entertainment journalist, you can see how he would have looked a lot like Nikki." Still, Rushfield also gave Fink credit where due. "She had the imagination to create a story out of all this," he continued. "The story of entertainment is not gray, dutiful marching towards the quarterly earnings report. It is wild, colorful characters doing completely ridiculous things. And if you can't capture life's rich pageant that way, then you should wonder how accurately you're representing the true experience of an industry whose business is entertainment." You might say Rushfield is capturing life's rich pageant, but without Fink's malevolence and ethically compromised behavior. The Ankler, which he started in late 2016, chronicles Hollywood in all of its naked theatricality, with a mischievous bent and a sardonic regard for the industry's towering egos. It's the sensibility Rushfield has nurtured for years through an array of DIY media projects, from his alternative college newspaper, The Hampshire Hypocrite, to his AOL-era email newsletter, The Barricade, to his early aughts fanzine, L.A. Innuendo, and now The Ankler. "I seem to have a history of starting troublemaking publications," Rushfield told me. The Ankler is expanding as a venture-backed Substack-hosted business, Ankler Media, for which Rushfield has joined forces with the veteran editor and executive Janice Min, who recently told me the goal is to become a primary resource about the entertainment business for the largest audience available on a global scale. Grand ambitions aside, Rushfield remains the Ankler's beating heart, and his trenchant analysis is the main reason people are willing to pay for it. Which is to say, not everyone is convinced the Ankler can or should be much more than that. or that it can become a bigger player without diluting Rushfield's boutique appeal. Depending on who you talk to, it's either a total must-read or, well, not quite so. Ankler Media will, of course, face hurdles in the punishing digital media economy. Subscriber churn, the vagaries of advertising, ever-increasing competition for attention in a world where anyone can start a Substack, the pressures that come with taking money from venture capitalists, and so on. Plus, it's in the same chase for high-end subscription dollars as Matthew Belloni's influential Hollywood newsletter at fellow startup Puck. Richard and Janice are world-class experts in building publications people want to read and pay for, and they have opportunities both in subscriptions and ad revenue, said Brad Flora, the angel investor who worked with Men and Rushfield for Silicon Valley's esteemed Y Combinator program. That said, the word "and" can often be deadly for young companies. Navigating that is a tricky thing for them. As far as founders go, Rushfield is a curious sort. A gruff and curmudgeonly Gen Xer who wouldn't look out of place in a film noir. He comes from an irreverent journalistic tradition and sees himself as a foil to the conventional trade press, allergic to the minutiae of carefully leaked studio announcements and agency scooplets. He's unique among his peers in that he built a significant brand from scratch with his bare hands, a middle-aged one-man band without the backing or support of a larger organization. He's also the only one whose name rolls off the tongue with the name with the same alliterative ring as the legendary columnist of yore, Walter Winchell, Hedda Hopper, Army Archard, Richard Rushfield. Rushfield is hardly a one-man band anymore. He and Men, who officially teamed up on Ankler Media in early 2022, Rushfield as editorial director and chief columnist, Men as CEO and editor-in-chief, are now part of a full-time staff of four, including a chief revenue officer and a managing editor. Those four salaries and a freelance budget are the only significant overhead. There's no physical office. Accounting and payroll are outsourced, and Substack handles the back-end tech stuff. The Ankler has enlisted a cabal of regular contributors, among them Rob Long, Peter Kiefer, Jeff Snyder, Vincent Boucher, Nicole Laporte, Rushfield's better half, with whom he has two elementary school-aged kids, Sean McNulty, who writes a morning briefing called The Wake Up, and the entertainment strategy guy, an anonymous data wonk who loves a good chart about the streaming wars. There are three Ankler podcasts and a budding events component. Think GabFest, screenings, cocktail hours. Come for the scoop on Michael Lewis's impeccably timed Sam Bankman-Fried project. Stay for the feature about the first 100 days of CAA-ICM. As with all startups, Ankler Media's finances are opaque. Last spring, after completing Y Combinator, the company raised $1.5 million at a $20 million valuation. The company says it is profitable, with about 50% of revenue from subscriptions and 50% from advertising, the type where film and television studios pay good money to woo members of the awards voting bodies. When I spoke with Men in December, she told me the Ankler landed in 38,000 inboxes every day, but she wouldn't specify the number of paying subscribers who get the full shebang of content for $17 a month or $149 a year. Rushfield told me that when he moved the Ankler to Substack, miracle the end of 2019, there were about 800 paying subscribers at $40 a year. By the end of 2022, according to Men, subscription revenue had grown by a multiple of nearly 40. Per my back-of-the-envelope math, that would put the Ankler's annual subscription revenue a little north of $1 million. I read it the second I see it pop up, says Richard Plepler, whose post-HBO life involves an Apple TV Plus production deal. They have a little bite, but their bite is always within the bounds of fair play. People read it. People respect it. Serious people send it around. Imagine's Brian Grazer told me, people in Hollywood like it. They think it's titillating and find it largely truthful. The Ankler's About page boasts raves from Bret Easton Ellis and media analyst Rich Greenfield. Other satisfied customers include David Zaslav, Patrick Weitzel, Kathleen Kennedy, Donna Langley, and Maureen Dowd, who told me, I just think men in Rushfield are smart. In conversations with an array of sources, I caught some whiffs that the Ankler might not be as essential to Hollywood's power class as it's made out to be. I think Richard's excellent, but the diversification of the Ankler feels like a stretch, said a well-placed source in the agency world who reads Rushfield and The Wake Up, but ignores all the other stuff. A second knowledgeable agency source concurred, I just don't feel like it's necessary reading. When something like Bob Iger returning to Disney happens, you want to hear what Richard has to say, but the other things on the Ankler, I still haven't figured out why I'm supposed to be reading them. A Hollywood heavy hitter told me he subscribes because it helps him make sense of a wildly disrupted industry in a challenging market. But, on the other hand, sometimes it's a little bit prurient, a little bit claustrophobic, and it's not always right. Take this for what it's worth, but when I ask another top player for his thoughts on the Ankler, he said he couldn't help because he doesn't regularly read it. Rushfield's fans appreciate how he swims against the current. He runs counter to groupthink in the town, said a senior executive at a major media company. He can be a much-needed contrarian voice. Here was Rushfield's take on Disney's ouster of Bob Chapek, a move portrayed as a hastily assembled palace coup that even Iger didn't see coming. It's amazing how quick a narrative has come out here, almost like they had it ready to go. The vote of no confidence from the deputies, the sudden phone call, the summons back to Destiny. All comes together very cleanly and nicely. Everyone on the same page. Nothing to see here. No conspiracy. Involving Bob I, anyway. Who was just minding his own business, working on a World War II book when the Call of Destiny came. The target that helped put the Ankler on the radar in its early days was Netflix. This was kind of the height of Netflix boosterism, Rushfield recalls. Everyone was saying, this is a miracle. Why would anyone else even think of starting a streaming company? They should all just shut down their companies and give their libraries to Netflix. And I presented a contrarian voice on that. Rushfield, in 2018, what if competition at the bottom stays so intense that Netflix is never able to command anything like monopoly power and has to start shrinking its offerings while raising its rates? In the old-timey economy, that's what folks call a death spiral. Netflix is far from a death spiral, but one of the biggest media stories of 2022 turned out to be the company's stunning subscriber stumble. The streamer lost almost half its stock value and came to be seen as a potential acquisition target. I asked Rushfield if he felt vindicated. I want to jump up and down, he said, and yell, I told you so, every day. Rushfield, 54, grew up in Pacific Palisades and attended Santa Monica's prestigious Crossroads School, where he overlapped with future hotshots like Matthew Greenfield, Jay Shores, Brett Morgan, Jason Blumenthal, Maya Rudolph, and Jack Black. Rushfield's younger sister, the TV writer Alexandra Rushfield, was friends at Crossroads with Jenny Connor, who went on to showrun HBO's Girls with Lena Dunham. At Hampshire College in Western Massachusetts, Rushfield frequented punk shows, X, Sonic Youth, Nirvana, Henry Rollins. He saw Black Flag in high school and wrote a decidedly gothy senior thesis about Jacques-Louis David's paintings from the French Revolution. Marat bleeding to death in a bathtub, etc. After graduating, he followed the grunge era playbook of loafing around without a plan. Then he landed an entry-level gig with the 92 Clinton campaign, sharing a small cigarette smoke-filled office with Noah Schachtman, now editor-in-chief of Rolling Stone. "Even when we were kids, he was a figure from a different era," Schachtman recalls. "I felt like he had stepped out of a Raymond Chandler novel." After working as a field organizer for several other Democratic campaigns, Rushfield pursued a writing career. His first byline, a front-of-book item for Los Angeles Magazine, highlighted a stand-up comedy show featuring rising stars like David Cross, Bob Odenkirk, Patton Oswalt, Margaret Cho, and Janine Garofalo. He became friends with a lot of these folks. "I think it ran two sentences and I got $25, Rushfield recalls. In 1998, he and his friend Adam Leff conceived a spy-inspired trend forecasting charticle, The Intelligence Report, which caught the eye of Graydon Carter. He gave them a contract with this magazine, where the column appeared several times a year until 2010. Rushfield has also written a few features for Vanity Fair. By the mid-2000s, Rushfield was working as a web editor at the Los Angeles Times, where a print higher-up once told him the only reason people wanted the online versions of articles was so they could print them out to read in the bathtub. He embraced the web, where he ended up spending the majority of his professional life. In 2009, Rushfield left the Times to become West Coast editor of Gawker. He then wrote a book about American Idol and did tours of BuzzFeed, Yahoo, and finally HitFix, where he was editor-in-chief before the site was acquired in 2016. "The second half of my career was working on every website, essentially," he told me. The Ankler almost didn't happen. After HitFix, Rushfield was accepted to the USC Rossier School of Education to pursue a graduate degree in teaching. Around the same time, inspired by the success of The Information, Jessica Lessen's subscription-powered tech news publication, he started sending an email digest to a small group of friends, who started showing it to their friends, who then forwarded it to their friends. Before he knew it, he had an impressive distribution list. "It started getting passed around very quickly to the executive class," Rushfield told me. He decided against USC Rossier and put his eggs in the Ankler instead. "It took me time to get up the guts to put down a paywall, but I made that leap." Rushfield first met Min at the Golden Globes about a decade ago. "Stuck at the kids' table in the back," Min joked. A former People and In Style reporter and editor who became a mid-aughts media star as the editor-in-chief of Us Weekly, Min was in the midst of her celebrated reinvention of The Hollywood Reporter, which she ran until 2017. In 2021, as Min recovered from a brief stint at the train wreck that was Kibbe, she and Rushfield started talking. "The Ankler had come to my attention because people were forwarding it to me. Pretty senior people in the industry," she recalls. "My thoughts were that entertainment was undergoing these crazy upheavals, both culturally and in the business model, and nobody was really owning that conversation. They made it official with a New York Times piece shortly before Christmas and entered the Y Combinator program several months later. In Silicon Valley terms," Min said, "Richard would be the product." The Ankler is no stranger to courtship. Penske Media, whose near monopoly on major entertainment titles includes THR, Variety, Deadline, Billboard, and Rolling Stone, made a number of overtures up until several weeks before Rushfield and Min announced their business relationship. Variety put an offer on the table in 2019 to add The Ankler to its newsletter lineup. Later, Penske Media boss Jay Penske pursued an acquisition. Additionally, Puck had conversations with Rushfield prior to its own launch. Min and Rushfield later explored partnerships with Axios and Lessen, an early Ankler booster who'd welcomed Rushfield into the information's inaugural accelerator program. Ankler Media's decision to remain independent, albeit with investors, and to continue publishing on Substack, where they're part of a growing crop of full-fledged publications, reflected a desire to control our own destiny, as Men put it. What does the Ankler's destiny look like? Men envisions a universe of bundled subscriptions and a push into international markets. The story of streaming is that it hit the ceiling in the United States before it was supposed to, she said. So everyone's saying, let's try to make money somewhere else, aggressively looking towards markets like Japan, India, Latin America, and that's a great story. When I asked for a pie-in-the-sky target of paid subscribers, she didn't flinch, 100,000. If they managed to get there, that's a lot of paying subscribers. It won't have been easy. I think they're off to a tremendous start, but the road ahead is hard, said Lesson, one of Ankler Media's investors. It's a really difficult long path. In early 2018, Lesson hosted Rushfield and the other members of the information's first accelerator class at her home in San Francisco. Here we are, 5 years later. I called Rushfield late one night while wrapping up this piece and read back his quote from Lesson's soiree. I couldn't believe I was getting away with speaking so honestly and freely about this industry back then, he said. I still can't believe I'm getting away with it. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.